The Extraordinary Ordinary is brought to you in partnership with Coca-Cola Euro-Pacific Partners. Hello and welcome to The Extraordinary Ordinary, the podcast from Women of the Year, which recognises and celebrates the achievements of remarkable women you've probably never heard of, but whose passion, dedication, hard work and fierce determination have changed society, lives and the world in all kinds of inspiring ways. Our guest today is Stacey Copeland, a trailblazer in the world of sports and a champion for gender equality. Stacey Copeland is not just an accomplished athlete, she's a history maker. In 2018, she became the first British woman to win a Commonwealth title in boxing, a groundbreaking achievement that showcased her incredible skill and determination. Her victory marked a significant moment in women's boxing and garnered attention and admiration for her achievements in the sport. But Stacey's story goes beyond the boxing ring. As a footballer, she represented England in the under-18s, played in an FA Cup final, and has also played abroad in America and Sweden. She's also a passionate advocate for gender equality in sports, using her platform to challenge stereotypes and empower women and girls to pursue their dreams no matter the obstacles they face. She's deeply passionate about making a positive impact through sport. And in 2017, she founded the Pave the Way project to challenge gender stereotypes, spark social change and make a difference. Stacey Copeland, welcome to The Extraordinary Ordinary.
Thanks very much for having me and thanks for that kind introduction as well.
No, such a pleasure. I mean, I'm tired. Just listening to all your achievements is absolutely incredible. I think, first of all, where do you get all your energy from?
I'm really, really lucky in that way that I've just always had loads and loads of energy. I did from being a kid, never wanted to go to sleep. I'd be up in the night sort of doing cartwheeling all over the place and practicing my boxing moves and my karate kid phase. I was practicing all of that in the middle of the night. I've always had bags and bags of energy, which I don't think was great for my school teachers or my family trying to keep me occupied as a kid. But it served me well going forward, because the nature of sport, as it was and still is for many women, I had to work full time throughout my sports career. So, you know, you do need a lot of energy to do it. But if you're doing something you absolutely love and you deeply believe in, then I think that helps you find the energy to do it as well.
I love that idea of you doing cartwheels in your bedroom with your poor mum downstairs. Can you just give us a sense of young Stacey? So, was it just football and boxing, or was it all other sports you were interested in?
I mean, I had a go at most sports. And it was actually my dad took me on holiday. I think we were in Cornwall, and I was doing all sorts of bounding about in the front room about 3 o'clock in the morning on holiday, and he came in, and that was it. I got banned from sugar for about 6 months in the hope that'd work.
And did it?
Not really, no. I didn't. But I think it was just part of my nature, really. And so I believe I always would have done sport. I think just which sports I chose depended on my influences, obviously the environment, the area that I lived. Like, coming from Manchester, it's unlikely I was going to be a surfer, or less likely anyway. So yeah, my obvious influences in boxing were my dad and my granddad. In football, not so much. I just really was drawn to it for some reason in the playground at primary school and joined in that way. But yeah, I tried all sports, but nothing impacted me like football and boxing. I just absolutely loved both sports from very, very early on.
And were you playing them both concurrently? So you were boxing and playing football concurrently as a child?
Yeah, because when I was at primary school, I played at break time and lunchtime, and the boxing gym was Monday, Wednesday, Friday nights. And I wasn't actually playing in a proper team until I was sort of 10 and 11 years old. I started at primary school just in the playground, and then I went to the team training session, like, to get picked, because they were starting to put a team together. And I got picked for the team. I was the only girl. And back then, although the ban on women's football had been lifted in 1971, the FA didn't officially recognise girls and women's football until 1993. So it was really difficult in the 80s, because there weren't any leagues or teams, you know, that type of structure in place for girls to play competitively. But you also weren't allowed to play with the boys. So I went along, I wasn't aware of this, and I went along and played in the game. And during my first game, it was so exciting being, you know, playing football with proper goals and a referee, and you were all in matching kit. You know, it was, felt a lot more serious than sort of just the playground stuff. It was brilliant. And then partway through the game, a parent and a coach on the other team recognised that I was on a girl and shouted across the pitch and insisted that I have to leave the game. And it was a horrible feeling. I didn't have the words to articulate exactly how that felt as a youngster. But now I know, you know, I felt definitely humiliated and I felt like a weirdo for doing the thing I loved. Now, for some kids, that's it. And it's understandable. You know, they don't want to continue with it because of that stigma and, you know, those feelings that come with that kind of opposition. But for me, for whatever reason, I wasn't quite wired that way. And I went home and I said, you know, you're going to have to cut my hair short. And so I had my hair cut short so I could pretend to be a boy. Like a lot of girls of my generation, pretended to be a boy and then I could play football. And it was also helpful in the gym. So when other clubs came, I could spar and they didn't know I was a girl because of that age. You know, when you're that young, you can't really tell. So that's what I did. And I mean, it worked out to an extent, but it did lead to other kids saying, why do you want to be a boy? Well, I didn't want to be a boy. I just wanted to play football. And at the time, that was the only way. And the other problem, I guess, was kit, which seems such a small thing, but it really isn't. Because there weren't any football kits for girls or women. There weren't even workout clothes other than aerobic. So I'm hardly going to wear a leotard to go football training, am I? That's ridiculous. So you effectively dressed like a boy, according to everybody else. But it wasn't dressing like a boy. You were dressing like a footballer. And boys' fit clothes and men's fit clothes were all that was available. So that's another big step now, that there are girls' kits that are tailored to girls and women's bodies. There's workout clothes that you can wear that are so, you know, that's a step forward. But back then it wasn't. So you're very much treated like a weirdo, really. And I think that has a, well, I know that has a very significant impact on how you feel about yourself, your place in the world. So yeah, so for me, I spent a long time absolutely loving sport and knowing that it was a place I felt best and happiest. But then this contradictory thing from the outside telling me I didn't belong there. And it was like, well, there must be something wrong with me then. And it took me a long time to realise that, you know, there wasn't anything wrong with me. I was actually, you know, an extraordinary girl at the time doing something completely different. And, you know, now I can feel proud of who I am and what I've done. But it took a very, very long time.
Stacey, that's absolutely shocking about that idea of a parent and a coach shouting at you and getting you sent off the pitch. How old were you? So this is in the 80s.
Yeah, I was 7, just about to turn 8.
That is terrible. That's so awful. I can't believe that happened to you. But as you say, to someone else, that might have been the end then. They would have just gone home and never played football again. But for you, that was a galvanising event. So you cut your hair and it didn't put you off. You just carried on playing. But how did you find formal ways to play football when you're in that environment?
Well, I continued playing for the school team. And then when I was not far off turning 11, we heard about this girls' football team that was being set up. I'd played in a couple of one-off tournaments with girls' teams, but that was just where they'd, you know, sort of done a summer camp maybe and got a load of girls together and entered as a one-off. But this was a proper team where you trained once a week, every week. And obviously, if you got picked, you were going to play every Sunday. And it was Stockport County. And I can't begin to tell you what that was like going for the first time and seeing all of these other girls who were just like me, who were wearing shin pads, wearing football kits, talking about football boots, just football mad, just like me. And it was like I'd found my tribe. It was an amazing feeling. And so then I was able to play in, you know, a proper structured team in a league. We had games every single week. And from there, my development just soared. And that was real opposite really to boxing, because that was, you know, the FA had got involved. And as I say, they set up the pyramid system. There was a proper pathway then with which to compete. And I was a competitive kid. In football, boxing was the total opposite, because when I got to that same age, 11, when you can usually start having skills bouts, me and my little lad mates that always trained together went to my granddad and said, right, you know, we're ready to box. And he said, great, we'll get you, you know, get your medical sorted, we'll get you carded. And then he looked at me and he said, well, you can't box, kid. I said, what are you talking about? And he said, it's illegal for females in this country. And I said, what are you talking about? And to, you know, an 11-year-old, illegal meant like burglary or, you know, proper crime, not a kid doing a sport they loved. But as it happens, that was the case. And it wasn't made legal until 1998. So that was it. It was literally a closed door for boxing. And I just couldn't believe it. But then simultaneously, football was kind of really starting to take off in that in that phase, if you like. I went into football, and thankfully I had something that I loved equally to boxing at that time, and was able to pursue my, you know, my love of sport in that way. So it was very fortunate in that sense.
Stacey, I'm listening open mouthed, just thinking, to an 11-year-old, as you say, if you're doing something illegal, you're not necessarily associating that with doing a sport that you enjoy, that you love. That must have been so hard to deal with. But as you say, at least you had then your football. Were you able to keep boxing training? Were you able to do your training, keep going with your friends, with your granddad, with your dad?
Yeah, I always kept up with my boxing training throughout my football career. Obviously, the huge benefit to me was that it was my granddad's gym, and my dad was a coach there, and my dad was a boxer. So that really helped in the sense that I always had access to the gym, whereas a lot of females were turned away from local gyms if they went along back in the day and up to very recent times. So I was fortunate that I always had access to it, but I also had people who encouraged me. It wasn't just a bit like, oh, go on, we'll let you come in. They encouraged it. And in fact, my granddad took me on the trip to New York with the boxing gym, with all the lads, just before I turned 11. And we went into one of the very, very high profile gyms there, which now boasts a fantastic roster of female world champions, but at the time didn't like women even training in the gym. And I went on the bag, and I remember one of the coaches coming over and saying, hey, no girls, like, you know, whatever. And my granddad sort of confronting him and saying, that's my granddaughter, and she's with us, she's part of the team. And if you're not going to let her train here, then none of us are training here. And I was thinking, what is he doing? Has he gone mad? Because like there was all these fights lined up. That's what we'd gone for. And I thought, what's he doing? And the bloke took a second, and then he went, okay, we'll let her train. And that was a massive lesson to me, without him saying anything to me, of being on my side, being in my corner, backing me, and sort of giving me the idea. You might have to fight for it, but you do belong here. And this is your space as well. So those are really important early examples for me. And therefore, I always had access to boxing. So I continued that training throughout my life.
Do you think you've got some of your granddad's spirit in you?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think I always sort of look at this one, because often you get asked, don't you, about who inspires you. And while you can really admire the achievements of sports people or people in any industry, you don't, unless you know them, I don't think you can be directly inspired by them like you are from the people in your real life day to day who've been part of raising you, part of your upbringing. You know their faults. You've seen what they've been through, how they've dealt with it genuinely day to day. Those people are your real inspiration. So family and friends, absolutely at the forefront of those who inspire me. And he absolutely was one of them, massively.
Can you tell us about playing for England in the under-18s? What was that like for a girl who'd been sent off the pitch at 7? To then represent your country, what did it feel like?
I'll tell you both sides to it, because I don't want to make it all sound like it's been awful, but it's really important given the context of this podcast. That actually, when I got my first call up, I was 16, and it is the most incredible feeling when you get that letter. You get an email now, but it used to be an actual letter, and you don't know if that's ever going to happen again. So even if you go on to have a million caps for England, your first one is always going to be special as a youngster. And I worked in a factory at the time. I was 16 and it was my first job. And I went along to the boss at the time and I said, oh, you know, I need a week off, but there's nothing left on the rotor. And he said, what do you need a week off for? And I gave him this letter and I stood there really excited. And he just didn't speak for ages. And I thought, this isn't really going how I thought. And then he said, you want me to give you a week off to play for a women's football team? I said, well, it is the England women's football team. And he made all these comments and jokes. And I said, look, it really means a lot to me. Can I just take it unpaid? To which he agreed. Now, I walked out of that interaction feeling stupid for thinking it was a big deal, not to play for the England football team, but the England women's football team. And again, it was another lesson that there was a difference. And I almost felt ashamed, really, for being so excited about it. And it did impact me, even so much as being there, you know, before the game, listening to the anthem, thinking, this isn't what I thought it would be. That was the impact that conversation had, which is awful, really. And we can't change everybody who's like him. Hopefully he's evolved a bit now. But what we can do is try and get the message, particularly to young people who've had less life experience, that even if they have an interaction like that, whether it's about race or class or gender, whatever it might be, that they can still feel proud of who they are and what they do, despite of those kind of attitudes. And I wasn't able to do that as a 16-year-old because I didn't have, you know, which is why I'm always happy to do podcasts like these, because stories are so important because they shape our narrative. And until we hear them, I had no other narrative. I just had this constant messaging of, you don't belong there, you're mocked, it's silly, you're not as good as, da, 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 da. I didn't have another narrative. Now I do. I've got all these other role models, women who've accomplished amazing things. And I've also learned about the history of women's sport. It wasn't that we weren't good enough and we didn't want to do it. We were banned. We weren't allowed. There were plenty of women doing incredible things in sport, but you have to learn about that history to know it's there. So I didn't have that toolkit and that narrative back then. So it impacted me massively. That said, playing for England is, you know, something that can never be taken away from you, and is just an amazing thing to have done, really. And especially now, in the last couple of years, the success of the Lionesses, to know that you've been some part of that. We all have kind of felt that, and it's resonated with us, and it's hit deep, very, very deeply for my generation. So I think it's had even more meaning now to us than ever before.
Do you feel part of those stepping stones? So for the Lionesses now, seeing them, do you feel part of that history, that those stepping stones, they're standing on your shoulders and your colleagues' shoulders?
Absolutely, because there tends to be three stages with social change, and that's what women's sport is. It's part of social change because of the stigma it's faced forever. And the first stage tends to be ridicule, which was what my generation faced constantly. The second phase is discussion, where it goes from, I don't like women's football, but she's good, or that team's good, or whatever, all the way through to the final stage, which is acceptance. We were only at the ridicule stage, you know, pretty much when we were playing. And we've seen the discussion part over the years. What's happened now, it's been accelerated enormously, that there's so many more people at the, gone beyond acceptance, actually. They've gone to be big fans and massive advocates of women's sport. They love it. They want to go to it, you know. They're shouting from the rooftops about it. So absolutely, having, you know, we've been part and witnessed those three stages now. To have been at, you know, the fan park in Manchester at Piccadilly for the Euros last year, in particular when we won, and the World Cup this year, although it wasn't quite as celebratory because obviously we weren't celebrating because they didn't win, but to see all of those people, different ages, different backgrounds, different genders, not just supporting and clapping along, but out of their minds, sort of cheering on the team, and the euphoria of when that ball hit the back of the net from Ella Toode and also from Chloe Kelly, we got that winning goal. It doesn't matter who's wearing the boot. If you're supporting that team and that ball leaves that foot and it's hanging in the air and hanging, and there's that collective intake of breath, and then boom, it hits the back of the net. You forget any of that. You're just caught up in the euphoria of the raw emotion of sport. There's very little else in the world that gives you that kind of emotion. You know, music's great, drama's great, whatever, but there's nothing like that raw emotion and the unpredictability of sport. And it captivated everyone. And to stand there, having had the experiences that I had and my generation had, and see that was enormously, I was an emotional wreck, to be fair, but it was ace. It was, yeah, just absolutely mega.
Got goosebumps just listening to you recreating those goals. And it was emotional for everyone. But for someone like you to have gone through what you have and to have, you know, really laid that foundation for them, for the current Lionesses. You must have been sobbing your heart out. Must have been incredible. Can you tell us then about the move from football to boxing? So you mentioned that women were banned from boxing when you were 11, when you went to step up at the gym. What happened?
It was Jane Couch was boxing at the time as a professional. And when there were two QCs, Dina Rose and Sarah Leslie, who came across this article about this female boxer who wasn't able to box here, and they were experts in law in the workplace, and decided, well, this needs challenging. So it was actually challenged on the basis of the right to earn a living. It wasn't actually about gender. That from the boxing board was the objection, that women shouldn't be allowed to box for various reasons that they had all ridiculous. But the actual, it was fought in the court and won in the court on the basis that you have the right to earn a living, and that Jane Couch should be able to earn a living boxing in this country. So that's when it was overturned. And since 1998, it's been legal in this country. So for me, I'd obviously gone and, you know, had a life of football, which was just incredible going over to play in America. I spent a pre-season in Brazil and then I finished playing in Sweden and played an FA Cup final and played abroad, played for England. I'd done everything that I wanted to do in football and it gave me some just phenomenal experiences, both as an athlete and a person. But I'd never lost that hunger and desire to pursue that first love of boxing. So when I got back from Sweden, I knew that was the time. And it happened very quickly from there. I won the national championships and then got picked for England, won the silver at the Europeans and just went on from there. Sadly, the Olympics and the Commonwealth Games was not an option for me because they didn't have equal weight categories for women, still don't. But my weight wasn't one of them. So that's essentially why in the end I decided to turn professional, because there was a big glass ceiling really in the amateurs, and the pros was a very unknown entity at the time. I was the only sixth woman in the UK to get a pro license, and four of them were inactive and they hadn't boxed for years, so it was new territory. But I felt it was important to, you know, start creating a pathway where others could see what was possible. And then obviously we got the opportunity to go to Zimbabwe and fight for the Commonwealth title, and having not been able to go to the Commonwealth Games, to then be able to do it as a pro felt really special. And what an incredible experience that whole thing was. It was just amazing.
Can you tell us, was your granddad there to see it and your dad?
Well, it was in Zimbabwe, so they didn't make the trip over with us. They were in my corner, though, for my national titles. I had my dad and my granddad in my corner for that, and that was very, very special, having, you know, those three generations and us all being together for that. It was me and my dad are the first father and daughter to both win a national title, so that was special. But it was live streamed back home, so all of my family and friends got together in various places to watch it together. So it was really special being able to bring so much joy to them as well, which of course is another fantastic thing about sport, if you can bring people along with you. And it was an amazing experience being there, like going to Zimbabwe. It was great. There was a massive build-up. It was on their free-to-air sports channel. So, you know, there's over 1 million people watched it in the end. The build-up was huge. It's just an amazing experience. And throughout the week, you know, we got to visit schools and an animal sanctuary, and which was great, although I'm scared of animals, but it was all right. And then the fight itself was extremely tough. The thing is about it is that after the fight, when I won, I didn't get a belt, and I knew there wouldn't be a belt a couple of days before.
Why not?
Well, this is what I needed to find out. A couple of days before the fight, I couldn't get into that because I needed to focus on what I was doing. So I thought, I've got to block it out. I've got a job to do. I just need to win the title. We'll worry about the belt later. And I had a picture of the belt that I'd taken everywhere with me in the build-up to the fight. I had it in the gym, in my bedroom, in my car, you know, everywhere to focus in the build-up. And I just had a picture with that, me and my coach afterwards. And when I returned to the UK, I rang the head of the Commonwealth Boxing Council and said what a great experience it had been, but it wasn't quite the fairy tale I had in mind, having not had the belt. And he said, well, I can explain what's happened. The manufacturers of the replica belt have ceased production. I said, well, what's that got to do with me? And he said, well, we do replica belts for women and real belts for men. So I said, all right, okay, why is that? And he said, well, there's more money in men's boxing. I said, I know, but even if it meant giving me the option of paying for the belt with my own money, that should have been an option, because I'm never, ever going to get that moment back again of winning that title, nor will my coach. We've no memories of it, we've no photos. That moment's gone forever. And you never get it back. And that's wrong to be denied that for any reason, but certainly for an aspect of the humanity that, you know, you can't change, like gender. And I said, that wasn't even the worst bit, really. The worst bit was coming back to the airport, and lots of mine and my coaches, friends and family had come to surprise us. They told everybody in the airport, and they were all waiting for this belt, and to come out and not have that belt to share with the people who meant the most to me and who've, you know, been behind me all the way was a gut-wrenching, I can't even put it into words, just a deep-lit gut-wrenching feeling, that sense of deep injustice. And I said to him, you know, there's nothing we can do about that now, so how quickly can I have a real belt? And he said, well, you can have one within a couple of weeks, but they are quite expensive, so unless you've got a sugar daddy, you probably won't be able to have one. Which again...
Did he say that?
He did. It's really difficult to put into words when... Because I thought, and I instantly thought back to that time as a 16-year-old, when I had that interaction with my boss and was put down and made to feel like nothing, you know, when I'd asked about having time off to play for England. And part of me thought, I can't believe I'm still dealing with this. I was 36 then, it was 20 years later, and I thought, how is this still happening? And I was incredibly frustrated, beyond angry. But I also thought, now I'm a totally different person. I've got that toolkit that I didn't have as a kid. I've got this other narrative. I know we're capable of amazing things. I understand the history of why we're where we are. I know we deserve it. I can vouch for that now. I can use that voice. And a voice is no good if it's not saying anything with meaning. I could use my voice in a way that made sense now and something that I believed in and understood. So, you know, I was able to challenge it on this occasion, unlike I was as that 16-year-old who walked out of the office just feeling terrible. And instead I said, you know, you shouldn't have said that. And he said, well, I didn't mean it in that way. And I said, well, there's no other, I don't know what different way you could mean it, but you shouldn't have said it. It's extremely derogatory to a professional athlete who's just made history. I work, I pay my own way anyway. So, but, you know, this can't happen to a future female champion. So I think there needs to be, we need to come up with something. So they agreed to make a women's Commonwealth title belt, which we got in the December, and it's obviously now that's available. And so as angry as I was, the way that I dealt with it, because I thought this anger's just going to eat me up, because I was livid, really livid. And I thought, I can't let this taint what has been an amazing achievement and experience. And so in the end, I thought, even though it was a horrible experience, I was the right person for it to happen to. I'm glad if it was going to happen to someone, it was me, because I'm the person who's going to do something about it. And it was great a couple of months ago when I was commentating on the boxing, and it was a Commonwealth title fight. And it was the first time that I got to see that belt be handed to a fighter, Emma Dolan from Nottingham, who got handed the belt. And it was just a brilliant thing, because you don't always get to see literally the change that you've been part of in front of your eyes. And so to see her get her moment, again, sometimes you don't realise the magnitude of things until you look back. And that was one of them, when I thought, wow, you know, she's having that moment now, because we were able to change things in 2018. So, you know, that was kind of how I framed it in the end. But yeah, overall, it was an amazing experience.
She's having that moment because of you, because of your anger, because the change that you made. As you say, you're actually seeing the change. I'm absolutely shocked that as a champion who's just made history, that belt wasn't available to you. It's so shocking. And also what you were talking about there was that throughout your career, you've been smashing barriers, had huge success, been a champion, represented your country in two sports. You've had to work throughout.
Yeah, it was, I very much missed the boat, if that's the right expression, of the money coming into women's football. It wasn't an option. When I was at Doncaster Bells in the what was called the Women's Premier League back then, we got 30 quid a game, and it felt like an enormous amount of money. You know, you get your 30 quid in a little envelope from the bus driver. For some reason, he was the one who handed out the money, and it was obviously it just covered your petrol, because I used to make the drive all the way over from Manchester to Doncaster two or three times a week. So, it didn't even cover, but it still, it felt like a really significant thing to get 30 quid. So that was an option. So I had to work. And then in boxing, now we're at the stage, and the change came due to COVID in women's boxing, because prior to that, it was a bit of the chicken or the egg thing. We can't put women's fights on headline shows because they don't sell enough tickets and da-da-da. But of course, if you don't advertise and give them the exposure, how are people going to buy tickets? And they still had the TV deals to fulfill the contracts during COVID, but they couldn't sell tickets, so they put women's fights on because they had nothing to lose. All that was going to happen is that a new audience was going to be drawn to it, really, and they were massively popular. The fights were excellent, and it's just gone from strength to strength, and now the women are earning, you know, really, really good money, and that's great. It didn't happen for me and my generation, so I worked. I don't regret that. I don't think it definitely didn't help when it came to injuries and recovery time and being able to fulfill your potential. But then, you know, somebody's got to be part of setting the groundwork and the foundations, and my generation were. I'm all right with that. And now I get to see all these things that these girls and women are achieving coming through, and that's fantastic.
Can you tell us about your Pave the Way project?
So Pave the Way began because usually when you become a professional boxer, you have a nickname like, you know, the assassin or the whatever, and My nickname's SpongeBob SquarePants, so it doesn't really lend itself to boxing. So instead, I decided to go with something that I stood for and represented and believed in. That was paving the way for the next generation, certainly in the sport of boxing for girls and women, but much wider than that, to inspire people and boys, girls, men and women. And we just did a one-off project with it on the week of my debut, visiting schools and doing a few community sessions and things like that. And it just really took off from there. So we've got charity status now, and it is all about, you know, removing the barriers to human potential that are there due to gender stereotypes, whether it affects boys, girls, men or women. Because I think what we can, the progress we can make for girls and women benefits boys and men also, on my view, and vice versa. So, yeah, it's very much about, you know, a lot of boys, a lot of parents have contacted me because their son faces stigma for wanting to do ballet or whatever. I mean, there's fewer things that are in the sort of don't go in the boy box. You know, there's far more things that aren't in the girl box that we can't do. But it's, if you're still that boy that impacts, then it's your whole life, isn't it? So that still matters as well. So, yeah, we've got a few inspiration days coming up between now and Christmas where we, you know, working to try and change hearts and minds and encourage people to not be held back by those stereotypes, whether that's careers, pursuing passions, how they are at home, how they view parenting, everything.
That's incredible. And so for listeners who want to learn more or to get involved or to support you, how do they do that?
Well, our Pave the Way launch video is being filmed in a couple of months, actually. So we're going to do like a proper official launch, if you like. But I do have a website, just Stacey Copeland on Google, it'll come up. And there's a page dedicated to Pave the Way on there. So, but yeah, our social media channels and website and all of that will be available soon. And hopefully we can be part of making a difference in other areas beyond sport.
That's incredible. So we'll link to that in the show notes for people that are interested. Stacey, I keep going back to that idea of you being the 16-year-old that got that call up for England and being made to feel small and humiliated by that. If there are young girls listening who are still experiencing that, who are made to feel they're not in the right place, what would you say to them?
I'd say to them, if you're a young girl doing sport, whether you're in an all-girls team or whether you're the only girl in a boys' team, depending on what environment you're in and what sport you're in, then it's a superpower. Don't see it as anything other than that, because what sport gives you is incredible for the whole of your life. It enriches your life beyond measure. It brings some of the most amazing teammates and mentors and inspirations in your life and the people around you. But also you learn so much about yourself, of you know, how to get feedback, because you get used to being coached, and therefore you can improve and dissect things and analyze them and find solutions. You learn how to control the controllables and ignore the things that you can't control. You have to keep reminding yourself of that one, but you do learn it. Resilience, obviously, because there's so many difficulties that you face in sport as an athlete and a human being. It's impossible to put into words everything that it gives you, but it is a superpower. And I think it's a superpower for anybody, but I think especially for girls and women, because of what it does for the rest of your life. And all of the studies show that if you've been a committed sports person, you're far more likely to succeed in the workplace, in, you know, in other areas of your life, have financial independence and so on. So these are crucial advantages, if you like, for your whole life as a human being. And for girls and women not to be independent on a male, that's when it comes to heterosexual relationships with men and women. For them not to rely on that and be financially independent gives them so many more options. It gives them a certain freedom. That's really important in itself. So it's endless, the amount of things that you get from it. But just turning up, especially if you're the only girl, and whether you're the best there, whether you're not the best or somewhere in the middle, whatever your level of ability, turning up to all of those training sessions and giving your best time after time after time is a superpower. So I would say that, really, just to think of it as nothing other than a superpower.
Stacey, you've already changed so many people's lives. And with the Pave the Way project, you're definitely going to continue to inspire women, girls, men and boys to achieve their potential. Thank you for that. Before we go, we've got our four quickfire questions that I just wanted to ask you. So the first one is, who are or is the woman or women who have inspired you the most?
The people in my family and friends. So in terms of women, my mum, her and my dad split up before I was one. So, you know, she had three girls and worked really hard, you know, to be able to provide for us. And that was an amazing example of her work ethic. And then my nan, my sisters, you know, who've been through things that you don't get trophies for, but it's incredibly inspirational.
What's the one piece of advice that you'd give your younger self?
I probably wouldn't, because you have to go through it. But I suppose if I had to pick something, it'd be value yourself.
I love that. What's the one thing you can't live without, Stacey?
Vimto. you know, it'd be exercise. I don't do well if I haven't exercised, although Vimto is true. But if I haven't exercised for a few days, I'm well grumpy. So I definitely couldn't do without my endorphins.
And finally, what's the one thing about you that would surprise people?
I used to do Michael Jackson impersonations when I was a kid.
Oh, that is amazing. Stacey, you've been completely brilliant to speak to. Thank you so much. As I said, what we're going to do is we're going to link to your website and the Pave the Way project so that people can support and learn more and get involved. But really what you do is just sensational. And there is a whole generation and generations of girls who owe you so much. So thank you, Stacey, for coming on The Extraordinary Ordinary.
No, thanks for having me. And thanks for doing this, because it's really, really important that, you know, this is part of sharing stories and changing that narrative. And hopefully the next generation coming through, it won't take them as long to feel valued and understand the history of women in sport and women in general.
If you have enjoyed this podcast, please rate and review, as it helps people to find us. To find out more about Women of the Year, go to womenoftheyear.co.uk. This episode was presented by me, Jo Baring, and produced by Claire Lynch. The Extraordinary Ordinary is brought to you in partnership with Coca-Cola Euro-Pacific Partners. They're one of the leading consumer goods companies in the world, making, moving, and selling some of the world's most loved brands. CCEP make, employ, manufacture, and distribute locally, maintaining a strong commitment to their communities. CCEP's success depends on their people. They want CCEP to be a great place to work, where people can grow, be happy, and be well in a safe, open, diverse, and inclusive workplace.